Welcome to the Maria Heller Show. On the net since 2000 and still going strong. If you feel like you're not getting the real news, if you feel like you're not connected spiritually, you have found your home. Maria covers a wide range of topics as only a snarky New Yorker can. Straight up, no chaser. No censorship, no corporate sponsors, thus true freedom of speech. Your subscription gives you unlimited access as a member of the smartest audience on earth. Relax and enjoy the education. Now, here's Maria.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to Tragedy and Hope with my friend and my co-host, Richard Grove. If you're not familiar with Richard, get over to tragedyandhope.com. Check out the link here at the bottom of my site for autonomy. Because if you're not aware of that, you're missing out on a lot. And I want to say good morning to Rich.
Good morning, Maria. How you doing?
I'm doing great, and I have a little surprise for you.
What do you got?
I have a little teeny surprise. Today is the actual day, 19 years ago, that I started this show. So you are my guest kicking off my 20th year on the net, and I believe you've been with me for 13 of those years.
This is true. Congratulations. I knew the 20-year mark was around in these 2 weeks because I saw your email, and you were nebulous about when the exact anniversary was, so I appreciate it. I'm very honored
to be on today's show. I couldn't think of anybody better to have on the show today than you. You've been with me for so long. You know, it's kind of funny when I think about how we got to go to Chicago together for that 9/11 conference. I don't even know that I've ever shared this with my audience. But the gal who was putting it together, her name escapes me right now. She was constantly...
Carol Brulé.
No, it was another woman. Maybe. Well, she was part of it, but there was someone else in charge. I don't remember her name. But she kept writing to me before that 9/11 conference, asking me for contact information for 9/11 people that I had on my show. And I said to her, how can you not have me there when I've interviewed all the experts on 9/11? You know, who knows better than me? I can put all their work together in my head. And that's how I got invited to be the keynote speaker. So I always feel
what a wonderful keynote that was.
I blew the hell out of that place, and I told them that was going to happen. I mean, it took me about 4 months to write that keynote, and it was funny because it was every night at 2 a.m. I was woken up, and it was like a vision. You know, I got two sentences, and then I'd go back to sleep. And I remember saying to the voice in my head, you know, you could give me this in the morning. I'd like to sleep. But I knew the way that information was delivered to me was going to be outstanding, and I told them that. And as you recall, I got plenty of standing ovations.
You got several.
Right. And, you know, a lot of times a lot of people pitch me to promote this event, promote that event, but they never think about inviting me, you know. And I've been here, you know, since the beginning. So, you know, I don't take offense at it, but I'm certainly not going to promote something they're asking me to promote when they don't respect my own body of work. So that's just the way I feel about it. So I don't know if I'm right or wrong, but that's the way I feel about it.
I think that's a healthy way to feel about it.
Well, let's look at the facts. You know, up until that particular conference, everybody was ignoring your work on 9/11. If I didn't embarrass them into having you there, and then, of course, everybody was begging me to help get you on their shows, you never would have been there. You know, and I remember in those days, and I said it, I believe, in my speech, you know, you all ignored the work of Richard Grove. You should be ashamed of yourselves. And I, when they knew my servers were burning day and night for weeks when I posted your information, that's when all of a sudden everybody wanted to know Richard Grove. And, you know, I find that in every area. It's not just the 9/11 community. It could be anything. It could be an environmental group. It could be a vegetarian group. It doesn't matter. You know, so when I tell people, you know, right before my latest 30-day ban on Facebook, which I got yesterday, I think after my other 30 days, I had about 7 days on Facebook before they gave me another 30-day ban, I had made a post. Here's the media I recommend Chuck O'Chelly, Richard Grove, Richie Allen, and myself. So I know you're not on Facebook, but I want you to know that I'm always promoting your work.
I certainly appreciate it, and I try to do likewise.
Well, I know you do.
Two people, yeah, we share many people that are overlapping in our subscribership, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, you do notice that, you know, what is considered alternative media or independent media has shrunk tremendously since Trump took office.
Well, I think you need to be pretty intrepid to engage in it, and not many people are cut from the same cloth as you are, Maria.
Well, you got to have a lot of guts, you know, because today, you know, telling
Moxie.
The right balls today, telling the truth is a very dangerous thing. I mean, we really are in 1984 on hyperspeed.
And we're really in a world of 1984 as far as the cybernetic technocracy that we are so witlessly embracing all around us.
Absolutely. Then I think about Brave New World. You know, my granddaughter is staying with me, and we started watching the series on Netflix. It's pretty exciting. It's a really good show. It's called Another Life, and it's a space kind of movie where they're going to meet aliens and whatnot. But what's interesting is while these people are transporting to space in this giant spaceship, they put them in what they call somatic sleep. And all I could think of was the Soma pill from Brave New World.
Right. And Huxley also wrote about it in his 1963 book, Island. And 63 is when Huxley died. He died November 22nd, 63. So he did leave some traces, not only in Brave New World, but in his last book, Island, which was like the next version of Brave New World. So the thing that strikes me from Brave New World that really affects families is that in like the first chapters, he shows how in their future, their technocratic future, the state sees parents as a threat. Parents are in the way of the state controlling children. So in the future, in Huxley's future, in the eugenicist future, in the New World Order's future, parents aren't, it's illegal to breed. It'll get to the point where to have a natural born child who's not DNA adapted prior to birth will be seen as a health risk. You won't be able to get insurance. Hospitals won't want to deliver that baby. It's going to be a whole thing in the next couple of years. They're doing this. And the eventual evolution of that is the state only needs certain personalities to be groomed and created. So they will take control and do the alpha, beta, gamma, delta. You know, the way they do it in Brave New World.
Right. Well, you know, you see it. They've given us enough movies to let us know what they're going to do. You know, the one you're talking about.
And that's what they do. It's a tacit agreement. They've told us they're going to do these things. We have not protested in the correct way. And therefore, they're going to continue to run rampant.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting because another scene in one of those episodes was this young man and this young woman who work on the ship. And she wants to have sex, and he has to admit to her that he never had sex. And she said, well, what about your girlfriend? And he said, we do virtual reality. And the fact that they've had sex through virtual reality makes the actual sex less than. So.
And taboo.
Well, at least it's safe sex, you know what I mean? At least you know you're not getting pregnant from that or a disease. But, I mean, when you look at it, you know, they're right in your face telling us what they're going to do and what they are doing. I mean, you look at all these children, these missing children, whether they're in these pedophile rings, the slave trade, the Trump camps, disappearing children. You have to wonder, you know, what are they doing with these kids? You look at Trump, he gave a speech before one of these Hitler youths, I'll call them. And when he rallied up those young people, all I could think of was exactly what we're talking about. You know, the mind control is out there and it's going fast.
Well, and if you look at what they did in Nazi Germany, like Hitler was voted to power. Hitler was given many reasons to ratchet up security and surveillance and all these sort of things. And so it's the dichotomy of the far right and the far left. So Antifa is spurred on by whatever white supremacy groups. the white supremacy groups are spurred on by Antifa, and then they feed off each other. And normal people who don't want to be driven to those extremes, they get squeezed in the middle like it's a vice. Like they're just squeezing those two different sides together. Now, this is interesting because it is the identical dynamic that preceded the first American Civil War from 1861 to 65. And in the letters of Solomon de Rothschild, who traveled America as a 30-year-old scion of a banking family that was multinational, he visited and stayed with all the most prominent families in the North and all the most prominent families in the South. And then he wrote letters back to his family. And then he said, basically, that the arguments in the North make total sense and they're willing to die for their arguments, and the same thing for the South. Mm-hmm. And that these two different cultures are like two steam locomotives under a, like two locomotives under a full head of steam headed toward each other on the same track. And that only calamity can follow, that neither side can be victor, and that all people will lose except for those who speculate and profit from such events and activities. So what you see is also in those letters, he says that most people did not want to be on either extreme. So back then, there were abolitionists and there were slaveholders. The slaveholders and those who defended it were doing violent actions, and so were the abolitionists on the far right. So historically, the Democratic Party in the 1800s was the party of slavery. At its helm at the Democratic National Committee for like 40 years was a guy named August Belmont. And August Belmont was the official money manager in America for the Rothschild family. He was trained by them. He was their official guy. So the banking family controlled the Democratic National Convention in the party for like the last, you know, from before the Civil War till like 1900, because there was August Belmont Jr. who has the exact same name, so it's a little confusing. And during that time in 1859, the Republican Party was created as the anti-slavery party. Mm-hmm. So driving up to the Civil War, you've got two extremes. The abolitionists were taking violent actions, as were those who were defending slavery. It's the same dynamic today. You have Antifa taking and taking preemptive actions in self-defense when they haven't been aggressed against. And you've got the other side on the far right or whatever that's called, and they take similar actions. And every normal, like the normal everyday people, we're not part of any of that.
Exactly.
And we're stuck in the middle.
Exactly.
So it's the identical plan. They're driving this country toward a second civil war because a lot of profit can be made from tearing down and rebuilding the infrastructure, more in the image of the United Nations one world state. It's to take away freedom from everybody, and to get that to happen, they need to divide and conquer. So they make everybody think that the person on the other side is your enemy, instead of knowing that your ignorance is your enemy. Like, your ignorance of who you are and what you are in this world and where you live is the enemy. And if you can eradicate that through learning, then you don't need an external enemy, and then you're more likely to find peace in your life, and more people are likely to find peace in the world.
Exactly. Well, you know, one of the things that I notice a lot, whether it's people writing me an email, whether it's posts on social media, Americans are exhausted. They're exhausted from politics. You never heard this before, Trump. They're not only exhausted, they're depressed, they're angry. They've got, you know, Trump anxiety disease that psychiatrists are seeing them for. It's just like every single day there's at least 10 huge breaking stories, and people are just whipped. They're tired of it. So I don't know if that's deliberate, if they want people to get that way, to, I don't know, storm DC or kill each other. I have no idea what the goal is there. But I really feel bad for the American public, and I feel sorry for myself because I'm still covering this crap. You know, yesterday I was a little late on my show, and I got a letter from one of my listeners who I love dearly. She went into a total panic because my show wasn't there. Okay. I want people to know, you know, I could get banned as much as they want, suspended as much as they want, but, you know, I don't live my life in fear. It just happened. I had something else to do before I got to do the show. So right. I don't want people
to
panic.
You're so consistent. I could see how somebody might jump to that conclusion. Right.
Right. But I mean, Richard, you know, I don't live in fear. I never have. Okay. I mean, I was.
Nor should you. Nor should anybody who's a listener of this show.
Absolutely. And I'm never going to live in fear because, you know, listen, when you get down to it, even Einstein agreed, this is all an illusion. All right. It is one of those illusions that never seems to end. But
albeit persistent.
Exactly. So, you know, I don't want people worrying about me, okay? The worst thing that you listen, when I was a kid, my father taught us to be very courageous, and we had to be, okay? And one thing he told us was, never fear any man. They can only kill your body. They can't touch your soul. And he told us that as kids.
And they can only kill you once.
Exactly. So it's like, okay, so what's the worst that could happen? I can go home and leave this planet? Oh, what a terrible thing. But in the meantime, you know, I'm going to keep covering the news because every suspension, every slam, whether it's YouTube, whether it's Twitter, where I'm permanently suspended, but Trump keeps his account, you know, whether it's Facebook or whatever, all it does is fuel my fire. It just makes me even stronger because I know that I'm a threat to this crooked system. And I like
that. But you're also different insofar as your philosophy of being is such that you don't fear death. So in history, one could read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations and the philosophy of the Stoics. And it was just a given fact that you're born, therefore you die, and you didn't fear being born, so why should you fear death? Because fear of death is a thing that is used to control human beings for the past thousands of years, and it's continued to use to control people today. So if you want to be free, you need to learn to overcome your fears, and you do that by learning and outgrowing that which you were indoctrinated into, because these fears also are not normal. Most people who have these fears, such as you're speaking about, have been indoctrinated through public schooling, and we're not given a chance to learn their way forward.
Well, not just that, but you also have religion, which was also put in place to give that people that same fear of death. Mm. You know, give us your money while you're alive. We'll give you something special. Right. We'll give you something special when you're dead. So there's a lot of fear. You know, you have to fear God. You know, that's an oxymoron to me. It always was, even as a child. I was like, well, if the Bible says God is love, why are you saying we have to be God-fearing? You know, it was something I couldn't compute in my brain, even when I was 10 years old. But, you know, I've always had that capacity to look at things and make sense out of it. And if it didn't make sense, I would question it, which, of course, always got me in trouble.
Yeah, that's always going to get you in trouble. And that's how you get weeded out of any system. You know, if you want to be a doctor and you start asking questions during that indoctrination process, they're going to weed you out because they don't want doctors to be inquiring. They want them to listen to the pharmaceutical sales reps and read the marketing reports.
Right. Well, you know, when I was in school, like you said, education, you know, is a waste of time and just programming. When I would recognize something like that, and it didn't matter if I was in middle school or high school, I would question the teacher, and of course I would end up in the dean's office just for questioning it. And that was a long time ago when it wasn't, you know, speech wasn't suppressed as it is today. So my father made regular trips to school, you know, but to their dismay, my father always defended my point of view. So, you know, I was very lucky to have a father, number one, let alone one that backed me no matter what. Even when, you know, he may have disagreed with me on certain things, but he always backed me. He always had my back. And when you look at parenting today, you know, especially where they want to, now you're saying, you know, they want to separate parents from their children, you know, make these kids, you know, just little Hitler youth. I don't know what else to call them. People need to pay attention, you know, and, you know, I know a lot of young people, they're very anxious to have babies. And I tell them, listen, there's a big difference between the romantic idea of having a child and the reality of having a child. And if they can't separate those two, they're not ready to be parents.
Good advice.
Well, that's my opinion. And listen, I've lived a long time, and I know this may sound old-fashioned, but I'm not coming from a place of being old-fashioned. Every child needs both parents. Okay? I mean, in the 70s, I would say, is when it really started taking off, divorce started taking off, and you had latchkey kids. You had children with one parent. That one parent was usually not home because they're trying to work to pay their bills. And children need the advice and the love of both parents. So if people aren't willing to...
Well, they popularized that through movies like E.T. Right. The dad's not present through the whole movie. That's why the kids can get in the mischief and all this stuff can happen in the first place.
Exactly. So, you know, if you're, you know, today, you know, what do they call it? A starter marriage. If you're not committed to each other, don't even think about bringing a child into this world, because that kid's still going to suffer. No matter what, the kid's still going to feel neglected or abandoned. Okay. I would say most people in America, if especially people I counsel and whatnot, most of them have abandonment issues. They could be 20 years
for
old.
Sure.
They could be 60 years old. They're still dealing with abandonment issues because of a missing parent.
And self-esteem. So those are the two things that crush a marriage. So now we're in a marriage consultation. Good job, Maria.
All right.
So the other, like, because here's how it works. You, in order to be good parents, you have to be together. And in order to be together, you have to have your own proverbial SHIT together.
Right.
As an individual. Your confidence, your competence, because that's where confidence comes from, your self-reliance, your proficiency in taking action, the consistency and methodology through which you solve problems and create new ideas or innovate to make things better around your place.
Mm-hmm.
Then you find another person who is doing likewise in their life, and you like vibe with them. You're having a good time, then that's a good platform from which now you can start a family.
Right.
But most people are like, need a crutch. They find another person, they need a crutch. Right. And then those two crutches are going to fall apart at some point, and everything's going to go kaflooey because the two individuals are not working on themselves. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a selfish nature that you need to become self-reliant. And beyond that, now you have the capacity to be generous, help other people climb up when they need, you know, when they need a hand up, these sort of things, when they need help. You are self-reliant enough that you can offer help. Because if you offer help at your own detriment, that's not very self-reliant. That's
right.
Not freedom.
Right.
Because you're always dependent. And
right.
Then you're likely to engage in more dependence.
Right.
So,
well, listen,
the
I'm
key
not
is build yourself as a strong individual, and then find another person who's trying to do likewise, and then you've got a good chance at not being divorced or having a starter marriage or ending up with dad body.
Dad body. Listen, I'm not knocking the single parents that I know and the single parents that are listening. I have friends who have raised 8 kids on their own. Whether they're male or female, I know men that have raised 4 kids on their own, but these kids are all damaged, okay? I hate to say it because I get to work with a lot of these kids. You know, a lot of grandparents dump their kids off at my door and want me to fix them, you know, somebody to talk to. I had one grandmother who, you know, said, you know, my grandson's going through this and that. I gave him advice, but he won't listen, but he listens to you. And I said, how long have you lived? You know, kids never listen to their own parents. You know, they'll take it from a stranger before they'll take it from their parents, because all kids think their parents are stupid. So I didn't want her to feel like I was taking her place, but I was trying to explain to her that it's always easier for someone to hear it from somebody else than somebody that they're related to. It's like me telling my son his whole life, you're so handsome. And he said to me, you only say that because I'm your mother. So he didn't believe it until other people said it. Okay. So I tell them, why do you think I would lie to you? You know, I would tell you were ugly if you were. But I've always tried to be honest with my kids.
And when did it come into the public vernacular and public conversation or the public imagination that the two beings that came together to create you are stupid?
Right.
They don't know anything.
Well, listen.
Right? Where did that come from?
Well, every kid, listen. When you're 16, 17, you think your parents are idiots because you're just trying to figure life out and you think you know everything. I'm speaking from experience. And
I'll affirm that. It actually goes on for some individuals till age 30 in my
right.
case.
Well, sometimes 90. But the truth of the matter is when I counsel parents, I'll tell them, well, this is normal. This is normal behavior at 16, 17. Don't worry. By the time they're 25, they're going to tell you how smart you are. And that's what happens. But everybody has to experience life to figure it out. Wow, I guess this would be a good time to promote my relationship book. So if anybody out there doesn't have my relationship book, you might want to order it. But, you know, I just look at this world today. I mean, you're a lot younger than I am, Rich. And you have a great family. You know, you and Lisa obviously meant to be together. I knew that from the first day I met the two of you. You know, you're both sharing your responsibilities and your raising of your son. You know, you both spent the time to really learn about each other and commit to each other before you got married, before you had the baby. That's the way it should be. But when I look at, you know, the young people today who are complaining their relationships aren't working, I said, well, let's be honest. You met on a sex site. I mean, there are sites. There are sites where you just, you know, you put in your information. You feel like getting laid that night. Some stranger shows up. You meet him somewhere in the dark. You have your sex. You go home. And then some of these people actually then think they can back into a relationship. But they know nothing about the other person. And I tell them, but you did it backwards. How did you expect it to work? You know, to me, it's just, it's perplexing, you know?
Well, for them, they're coming up in the world. They just think that's how it is. They don't know there is another way or another set of qualifying, encountering questions to, like, gain information from, right?
Exactly.
So the meaningful questions in life are not the ones on those sites that are being used to create your profile. They're superficial and, like, ephemeral, fleeting, not tangible, long-lasting qualities. So it's not a good way to...
Right. I mean, if the first thing you're going to say to somebody instead of, you know, back in my day, you'd be at a bar and, you know, some guy would come up to you and the first thing you would say to each other is, what sign are you? You know, which was a good thing, okay? Because I learned in retrospect that Libras are deadly for me. But today, your first introduction is a screenshot of your genitalia. Okay, I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm just saying that where do they expect it to go from there? You know, if a girl says, well, I really don't like the look of that guy's penis, so I don't think I'm going to meet him for a drink. I mean, people got to get that, you know, the sex has also been thrown in their face. It's been degraded by society, you know, whether through pornography or whatever. And the beauty and the spirituality of the true higher form of sexual connection is totally gone.
Yeah, they have no idea of its potential.
Exactly. You know, the purpose of, you know, real sex is to be able to meld as one person and experience the eternal, you know, climax where you both can go basically out of body together and travel the universe during the experience. I guarantee you very few people have had that experience.
Maria's recommending it. There you go.
Well, hey, you know. but if you think that, you know, after you just, you know, had some casual sex with somebody, you know, 3 weeks later, the sex is still good, and so let's get married, and then wonder why it didn't work out when you don't even know the first thing about your partner, goes back to what you said earlier. You know, you have to be healthy in mind, body, and spirit in order to attract a healthy partner where both of you aren't looking at each other for what you need, but looking forward and then together.
And you have to do something substantial, like, you know, take some trips together, learn about yourselves, learn about the boundaries of the universe. Like, what is this place? What's going on here? Why do we go to work every day? You know, did George Washington have a marriage license? Yeah, start asking the hard questions.
Right. But, you know, these TV shows continue to reinforce that. You know, where sex is just nothing, it's meaningless. You know, it's just a physical thing, which is okay. Sometimes you can have casual sex. You don't have to be in love with everybody. You know, it's another bodily function. But I think that, you know, in a way, it's really hurting young people today, especially those that are looking for substance in a relationship.
Well, culture is there to damage you before you can figure out who and what you are and what you could be doing. And they want you to limit off all your potential before you discover your true potential and ignite it for yourself. If you discover your potential and you ignite it and you catalyze it toward your own means, your own goal, your life's going to be very different than if you continue in the learned helplessness and I can only do this and I'm limited to this and I don't have enough money to do that. You're going to be exactly what they want you to be, which is a switched off automaton who is just waiting for the next news to be released to tell you what to do. Which is people under control. That's not freedom.
Exactly.
That's not what the future should be, but that's the freedom that they plan for people. You have the freedom to obey and to not have any power of resistance. That's how they want world peace. That's their design. They're very well-intentioned people. They just, you know, it has to be at the expense of your freedom to have that luxury.
Exactly. Well, you know, let's go back to what you started talking about earlier with Hitler's Germany. What people don't realize, because, you know, the Jewish people have made such a big deal over the Holocaust just affecting them, was that the first people that Hitler went after were his political opponents, the Germans. And when I look at here in America, where we actually have a president of the United States ripping on his political opponents in his opposite party, ripping on black people, ripping on minorities, ripping on women, it looks like, you know, okay, right now we have migrants in these Trump camps. Who's going to be next? You know, and it takes me back to when I interviewed Daniel Ellsberg. And one thing I remember at the end of my discussion with Daniel was he said to me, "I guess I'll see you in the camps, Maria." And my answer to him was, "Well, at least I'll be where the intelligent people are." So, you know, everything is perspective. If you're going to give in to fear and not speak your truth, well, then what kind of life are you having? And I'm not one that's ever going to want to be in the shadows whispering. That's not my thing.
Well, that's the other thing that keeps people whispering is they're afraid of death. That's how fear is used to keep people capitulated. Going back to World War II, it's the same way they get people to, you know, come out of their house, go down the street, get on the bus, now get on the train, because nobody resists. They're not armed. They're never taught that they own their body, that they have the right to self-defense, because Europe never became free. In fact, very interesting fact, until the American Revolution, the only people on the planet who could own property were popes and kings.
Well, right? I would say they still own a whole chunk of it.
I'm sure they do. Yeah, I'm sure they do. But the idea that an individual could own property and have the same rights as a king, those are the foundational elements that made British colonists, yes, they were slave owners because they were British colonists. And if you want to take that 100 years forward, the British colonize South Africa and make slavery. This is what they do. So when people are like, the founding fathers were slave owners, yes, but they also put into place how to end slavery. And it's in there that they couldn't do it before 1808 because there were all these other contracts in place. But these were considerations. And when Thomas Paine was working with Thomas Jefferson, Paine wanted abolition of slavery in the Constitution. So these ideas were around and it took time to grasp, but they never would have come to fruition had we remained in the British Empire.
Right. But then we went around doing the same thing. Whatever you want to call it, it's still colonialism. Just look at poor Puerto Rico. Okay.
Well, okay. So this all comes about. So through the 1800s, after 1814, the British go about taking over America by other than military means. So basically, the British Empire was being funded by their monopoly on opium. So after they get kicked out of New Orleans by Andrew Jackson, they go focus on India and subjugating India and China with opium. And that's why we don't get trouble from the British until 1898, when they want to become close buddies with us again. And they say, hey, let's get into this Spanish-American war. We need the American part. You guys got to go over the Philippines. Rudyard Kipling, who is a Freemason friend of Cecil Rhodes, wrote a poem called The White Man's Burden, encouraging America to get into the English-speaking idea of controlling the whole world. So, yes, America has been used as the property manager for the British Empire for the past 100 years. And the way that comes about is there was always a group of families in America, even after we fought for independence, who were loyal to the British Empire. Why? Because they got their money and their fortunes from opium. Their family names like Delano, Delano Roosevelt, his family was in the opium trade. John Forbes Carey, the Skull and Bones guy, his family was in the opium trade. The guys who created Yale, the guys who created Skull and Bones, the people who funded Harvard, those grandiose buildings were built with the pain and suffering of people in India and China during the 1700s, 1800s.
Exactly. You know, that brings to mind one of the first shows I did, probably the first year on the net, on the book The World is a Ghetto, which gives you the entire history of the opium trade. All the way from then till now. And I believe that interview is still in the archives somewhere. So people just put in World is a Ghetto or just get the book. Rich, let's take a short break and we'll come right back. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Relationships. You hear a lot of experts talk endlessly about having a successful relationship, but do they? Maria has combined her years of experience, spirituality, knowledge, wit, and wisdom about relationships into one small, concise, useful book, Relationships: Cutting to the Chase. The most important relationship of all is the relationship you have with yourself. If you're not in a loving, healthy relationship with yourself, you'll continue to have problems in all types of relationships. Maria shows you how to have one and great relationships of all sorts in her latest book. You can find the book at maria.net. That's M-E-R-I-A.net. Under Maria's books, Stop Suffering and Enjoy a Happy Life with Fulfilling Relationships. You may decide to buy one for everyone you know. Order your copy now at maria.net. Now back to this fascinating show.
Welcome back to Tragedy and Hope with my guest, Richard Grove. And I'm happy to let you know that his autonomy is in season two. And I'll tell you what, it's probably better than most of the shows you're watching on TV, because his autonomy plan actually gives you tools to make your life better. So, Rich, what's going on? What's the latest with autonomy?
All right. So in the beginning of June, I finished up season one. And so it ran 17 weeks in the first season, and in season two, it's probably going to run 12 to 15 weeks. In between seasons, we had the most amazing time because I spoke at the Red Pill Expo in Hartford, Connecticut. That was early June, like June 7th. Mm-hmm. So G. Edward Griffin every year has this expo where he brings in freedom-minded people, and they share the stage and they discuss provocative ideas that have a lot of facts and evidence behind them. Mm-hmm. So I was speaking at the conference, and I had promoted it during season one. Well, a couple students decided they would go, and a couple more students decided they would go, and then they started arranging among themselves travel and Airbnb and hotels and doing all that stuff. And then by the time I spoke at the conference, there were several dozen students who had traveled from as far away as, you know, Mexico City or Amsterdam or Hawaii. And they see me because I speak, you know, 5 hours a week. They don't need to hear me, but they came to meet each other because they'd been through this course working with each other. They were so excited and had the best time. So for like a week, I would have anywhere from 10 to 30, 40 people at my house at night with a bonfire and people getting together and talking and other speakers from the expo coming by. So that was a great time. And then I thought I had 2 weeks to prepare for the next speaking engagement that I did in New Hampshire at the Porcupine Freedom Festival. But really, it was only 1 week between the conferences. So I jammed, I got ready, I went up there. And I did a longer version of my presentation, but basically what I do is I lay out, here's how and why, and here's the evidence of why schooling's broken. It's not going to be fixed. They're trying to turn people from individuals into collectivists, where you don't have any personal property, you don't have any rights as an individual. And I lay out all the evidence over 100 years. Here's the Carnegie Foundation, here's the United States Congress, like here's the facts. I give the audience cheat sheets. Uh-huh. So I'm like, here's why it's broken. Here's why it's not going to be fixed. So we need to create an alternative solution that makes this problem obsolete. So then I introduce them to autonomy, which is a basis of learning how to develop yourself as an individual and adopt a culture of excellence everywhere you go. And that starts to be a very attractive value to interact with other people, network, get job opportunities. And then from there, we layer on heavy doses of high value skill sets, and then people find where they're inclined to invest some time. They gain proficiency and confidence, and then they get to test it out in the real world, and they get real time feedback from all the other students because we do this online every day.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. So it's like starting your own community. And that's, you know, what we need to do. It kind of reminded me of when I used to do my medicine wheels and have people from all over the world show up. Basically just talking about spiritual stuff and the environment. You know, I look at the environment and the environmental destruction going on, and it makes me fear for the future for young people. And, you know, for me, I've been, you know, an environmentalist for, you know, 30 or more years. So it hurts me even more because some days I feel like, oh, God, did I waste all my time trying to warn people of what was coming and what they could do to prevent it? But then, you know, there's always groups like yours and other good groups out there that are working hard to try to fight the system. We'll call it the system.
Yeah, I'd say that the evolutionary advantage is we've had an online community for the past 13 years now, 15 years, probably 13 years, right? And that's good for certain aspects. People need to know that other people know and they like to interact and exchange information. What I do with autonomy is I take that and the untapped potential that schooling had but never delivered, and I combine those two. So it's like an educational community where everybody's actively working on developing skills and participating in integration exercises to help make those skills part of their being so that they can readily demonstrate those skills in a variety of situations, all of which add value to their life.
Right.
So the lifestyle of autonomy comes from not just the community aspect, because it's nice to talk to other people who are of like mind, but how to work with each other and leverage each other's skills to overcome our biggest challenges in any of our lives. So somebody could be coming in and they have a problem with their divorce or they have a problem with their job. Any of these situations, the you know variety of skills that we have and tools that we can use are, well, we haven't encountered any situations that we didn't have the tools for yet.
That's
so that's a good thing. So it could be a communication thing. It could be a learning thing. It could be a constructional type of thing, an engineering type thing. So we work with each other to help each other figure it out. So it's like you wish you had this cool group of friends that lived in your town and that you could be like, hey, I'm working on this thing right now. Does anyone know about this? Mm-hmm. And if you know, and we help each other out, right? So in the absence of that, we do that online. And then when there's opportunities, we meet each other in real life. And then the relationship even goes to that next level because now
exactly.
You're personal friends. You've met. You've spent time. You've shared meals. You've, you know,
right.
Been on these
well,
journeys
listen,
together.
Human beings need community. And in a lot of ways, technology is isolating people. But you still
yes.
need community. You still need one-on-one time. You know, back in the day before, you know, we had governments or, you know, asking our government to take care of us, people got together and figured things out in their own community. I mean, you could see that whenever there's a flood in the United States or a fire or whatever. Americans pull together. They don't care what that person's political system is, religious system is. They know the right, intuitively, humans know the right thing to do. But it shouldn't only be in times of disaster that they pull together.
Well, the thing, the disaster pulls out the communication barrier. Usually, yes, we all want to work together and do these cool things, but we lack the ability to articulate our needs, our desires, our vision to other people mm-hmm. to gather more interest and take action. So part of what autonomy does is it takes away that natural fear of speaking to strangers, talking in front of people, making new friends, learning how to ask for a job. Because today, you can represent yourself on LinkedIn or you know Snapchat, whatever you know, whatever you're doing. But that's digital. If you can go up to talk to another human being, articulate your position, showcase your value, present them with an offer, and get them to make a decision, you cut past that line of thousands of people waiting for a job because you just went around and talked to the person. That is like a trump card. If there's anything Trump you want these days, it is the trump card of knowing how to communicate to people and get your needs met. And circumvent all this, let's submit your resume, do your online thing. Like, this is how people with high-paying jobs actually get jobs. It's not through waiting in line and submitting a resume and doing these different, jumping through hoops. People with skills don't have to jump through those hoops.
Exactly.
So it's like a VIP pass for life.
Exactly. Well, it's an old adage, but it's still true. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. So if you're not in their face constantly and you think, you know, you put in an application online, they're going to get back to you. You got a long wait. You know? But to confirm something you said earlier about education, every young person I talk to, some that are still in school, some that are still going through college because they know they have to have a certificate, even though they know they're not learning anything. some people in their early 20s all tell me the same thing. School provided them with no life skills, nothing useful.
They can't, and a bunch of trauma.
Right. They don't know how to balance a budget. They don't know anything about money. They just don't know the basic skills you need to get through life. And they're angry.
Yeah, they don't know how to survive and thrive. Mm-hmm. And likely their parents never fully learned that either. So now they're second generation trying to figure out, and it's a sink or swim situation. And yes, you lost 15 to 20,000 hours of time getting your official education, and you still can't survive and thrive in the world. Like, complaining about that's not going to help. What you need to do is figure out exactly what do you need to know to bring money in the door consistently, ethically, and in a way that you might have a smile on your face the whole time when you do it.
Exactly.
You're not going to get that from schooling. You have to do that by exploring your passions.
Right. Well, I constantly am screaming, especially at my own granddaughters, to live their passion and live their dream. But it reminds me of, you know, a line out of a 60s song, which was, when I look back at all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. So, but, you know, those words, they stand true even today. I mean, these kids don't know basic math. They don't know how to write a check. They don't know anything. They don't know about mortgages. You know, they always keep money a mystery in America. And it's kind of like our vote. You know, it's always a mystery. Who's counting the vote? Because they always count them in the dark, not in front of you. But I think
they teach us blanket statements like debt is bad. Well, right. Is it? What if I use debt to buy an asset and then I don't pay money on the asset because I'm using debt to buy it? Is that bad? Mm-hmm. No, actually, that's really smart. So it violates the rule, right?
Right.
Yeah. So maybe that shouldn't be the rule, right? Maybe you should teach people that assets are good to own and liabilities are poor investment. Like, they're not investments. That's spending. So when you buy a liability, that's spending. And when you buy an asset, that's investing. And just think of that with your time and your money. Mm-hmm. You're on Facebook looking at, is it liability or asset time? Are you making money from Facebook or is Facebook making money from you?
Right.
Somebody's being sold. Every time there's an interaction on the internet between you and the internet, somebody's being sold. So are they selling you or are you selling it? Are you providing massive value to somebody else and transacting? Mm-hmm. Or is Facebook harvesting your every click and like using you like a slave?
Exactly.
Learn how to be master of your own domain, captain of your own ship.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find with Facebook is a total waste of time. The only reason I even look at it is to see the general pulse of insanity that's out there. I don't think there's a social media filled with more insanity than Facebook. Yeah. I mean, it's almost a form of entertainment, but for me, it's like taking a poll. It's like the heartbeat. I get to hear the heartbeat of America. But no, I can honestly tell you, I've never made a dime off Facebook. It's a waste of my time. But I have to stay on top of it, you know? So I'm twicks and tweens. So now I'm in my favorite position because when I came back 7 days ago, I made a post that I don't give a flying F if Nazi Israeli Trump-supported Facebook kicks me off again. So for me, I tempt them to see how long it's going to take. But I enjoy the pleasure of being ghosted there because now I'm invisible. I don't have to comment. I don't have to get upset. All I got to do is just look at what's going on. And it's like being a spy on the wall, like a little fly on the wall, spy on the wall.
Most people, if they just took their Facebook time or their Netflix time and reinvested that into an activity that actually made them a stronger person, a more confident person, a more patient, polite, persistent person, then you'd be doing something with your time and you'd feel better about it.
Right. But, you know, people like the idea of being entertained, you know, 24/7.
Entertainment is watching other people have fun.
Exactly. I've always said I'm a doer, not a viewer. But that was usually when some that was usually when some man wanted me to watch porn with them. And I would say, yeah, I'm a doer. I'm a doer, not a viewer. Why do I want to watch somebody else have sex when I can be having it? So I made you laugh there, Richard.
I was picturing your grandkids listening.
My grandchildren know me like a book. There is absolutely nothing I hide from my grandchildren. I never have.
Nor should you. They should know how cool you are.
Well, they respect me and they do know. I mean, right now I've got my granddaughter staying with me And I've been taking her to the gym with me every day. And she has found out.
And you're mentally alive. Right. And a lot of people just they teach themselves that they're old. And then they just start tuning themselves off, like out and off over a series of years, right?
Right.
And for those types of people, it's like, there was a guy, what's his name? Dave Wildman, I think his name was. He was like helicopter snowboarding in the Andes Mountains at age 83. He died at age 84 of some fast-moving cancer. But just to go to show people, it's like age 83, right, jumping out of a helicopter with a snowboard into the Andes Mountains is something you can do if you take care of yourself mentally as well as physically. Because the mental apathy is what drives Alzheimer's. Like, if you don't care, guess what? Alzheimer's is creeping in on you, because that's how it works. It starts with not caring, and it escalates to, we don't need to have those neural pathways in use anymore because you don't care.
Well, you know.
Care is a major thing.
Well, listen, the brain's a muscle like every other part of your body, and it needs to be worked. If it's not worked, it atrophies. And, you know, being able to take my granddaughter in the gym and train her, and everybody's like, your grandmother will kill you. She's like the strongest person in this gym. You know, we have a good time, but I'm told her, I'm teaching you life skills. If you want to be my age and be fit and strong, and you're going to need to be for what's coming, this is how you do it. It's a lifestyle. It's never going to change. The eating never changes. The working out never changes. This is what you have to do.
But here's the other thing. You are also the most mentally tough person in that gym. Do you think there's a connection between your mental toughness and your physical toughness?
Most probably. You know, one day at a different gym, no one had ever talked to me. I was there 3 months, and nobody even said hello except this one old guy. And after 3 months, because I'm not used to that, gyms are usually very social places, I said to this old guy, I says, you know, I've been coming here for 3 months. Nobody talks to me. What's that about? And he looked at me and he said, all people have to do is look at you to see that your intelligence level is so much higher than ours. There's no way they're going to approach you. And I said, what? And he said, he had said something else. And I said to him, well, then how come you talk to me? And his answer was, I'm 75. I don't give a shit. That was his answer. So he said I was intimidating.
There you go.
But I didn't consider myself intimidating. You know, I'm not going to apologize for knowing my way around the gym.
No, but you haven't learned helplessness either. You haven't learned, like, you know, you resisted the programming, Maria, and that's partially because of you, and it's partially because of your upbringing with your dad and your mom and how you were brought up.
Well,
and the time you were brought up. And I think it's important to share that energy with younger generations who really don't have that type of surroundings. They don't have that benefit.
I know, absolutely. I mean, you know, I lived through the 60s, you know, and I wasn't 5 years old. You know, I mean, I was fully aware, you know. It was like, yeah, I'm 16. We've got race riots going on right in front of my house. You know, truckloads of cops on all kinds of vehicle coming out of these truckloads. People getting their heads slammed. People getting mugged. We're dragging the victims into our house to get them help. I mean, you know, I grew up at a time where you participated in life. You didn't sit back, shut your window, and lock your door. Because it was really a neighborhood. You did everything you could to protect your neighbors. Everybody knew their neighbors. What a shock. But, you know, I mean, I grew up in tumultuous times. And I tell my granddaughter, you know, West Side Story wasn't just a movie. I said, I grew up in that without the music. You know, I mean, I watched gang fights as a kid, you know, 5 and 6 years old. I mean, this was, you know, I grew up in, you know, the best and the worst time of America. But, you know, my generation didn't sit back. Unfortunately, a lot of my generation did sell out, and they get slammed pretty hard on social media. The baby boomers created all of this. And I'm like, hello,
I never sold out. That's just the buy into the fear. That's just the buy into the fear and say, learned helplessness is my friend. I can't do anything to change myself. So if I can't change myself, how can I change the world in any positive way?
Well,
and
but,
they cash it in.
But doesn't every tenet, every religion go to the same thing? You know, change begins with you. That's all people really have to do is change themselves. And that's how you fix the world. But if you're convinced that you can't change anything, if your self-talk is always negative, and I know people like that, nothing's going to change for you. But that's everybody's choice. You have a choice in the morning. You're either wake up and say, you know, I'm going to let the system kick me to the curb, or you're going to wake up and say, I'm ready for a new day. You know, I like that one meme where people say, be the kind of woman that when you wake up, the devil says, oh God, she's out of bed.
I think what people could do is just go cold turkey on learning about the daily news. Just quit the news. Don't need to know about Trump, Clinton, Democrats, Republicans. Don't need to know about any of it. Mm-hmm. Let me just focus on me and what I'm eating and what I'm doing and the things I...
Right.
Stuff does not affect what I need to do to survive and thrive in the world.
Well, that's part of why I do my show, so other people don't have to. Don't have to watch the debates. Don't have to do this and that. I'm willing to do the work. I put it together. Here it is. It's an hour, hour and a half. It tells you everything you need to do. You got 23 hours left to your day. You don't right. have to do what I do, even though people worry
delegate
about
that.
Me doing
yeah,
it.
Delegate that to somebody to go through that for you that you trust.
Exactly. And that's what my listeners appreciate the most. And it's okay for me because they know I'm in balance. I'm not spending the rest of my day on this crap. You know, I got the gym to go to. I got stores to go to. I have, you know, dinner to figure out. You know, I get into life. But you can't let anything obsess you like some people are, because they're becoming basically super depressed and suicidal. And they don't understand that the world's always been this way. They just know about it now.
And they're better at projecting it on people now. They're more effective and efficient. So really, what you're like a world news individual translator, like a personal translator for global news. Like you know, instead of trying to expose yourself to that toxicity, Maria filters it through for you so it's healthy.
Right. Well, you know, I got to thank my dad for giving me great study skills, because I don't think I'd be able to handle the workload without it. You know, I can scan through everything, get the meat, and put it out there. And also the bullshit. You know, I've always been able to smell that. So that makes it even easier for me when I look at some news stories. Say, yeah, this is bogus. I'm not even going to cover it. So that's the way it rolls. But everybody's got their part to do here. You know, people forgot we come to this planet to enjoy our lives. But, you know, some people, you know, if they get a 1 week vacation from work, they don't even know what to do with it. So it's choices. It all comes down to choices.
And choices are one of the few places that you have the freedom to think or not to think. Freedom revolves around choice, but it's our responsibility to think and we're not taught in school, so that's why it's kind of a like a circus out there. It's a circus because it could be a lot more organized and efficient and effective, but they prefer it to be more chaotic because they make a lot more money that way.
All right. Well, you know, wise Native American many moons ago said, when the last tree's been burnt and there's no water to drink, you'll find out you can't eat money. That's where that's going to go. Anyway, Rich, this was a pretty quick hour. I want to thank you so much for joining me on this special day.
Thank you so much, Maria. Happy anniversary. And thank you to everyone listening.
You too. And my love to your family.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. Take care, Rich. Richard Grove. All check right. his work out at Tragedy and Hope. Check out Autonomy. You're not alone. There are smart people on this planet. There are groups forming. It's one of my purposes, basically, in wanting to move back to the valley so I can start having large gatherings of people again, because I live in a Mormon town, so it's not going to happen here. So we all have to, you know, we all answer to ourselves. So you either choose to live your life for you or you live your life for the system. To me, the hell with the system. Anyway, thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the show, especially some of you who have been here since the beginning. Don't think I've forgotten any of you. And I'll see you guys next time.
Thank you for listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.